Cheer up, Brian. You know what they say? Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble. Give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your life, just
so always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
Come on, Tom, cheer up.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on.
Yeah, you can say that again. You can say that again. Terrible time of year in the bunker. Right. Way down deep in the Indiana ground. That rich Indiana ground where they raise all that corn that then they turn around and ship it all to China. Or try to make something to run cars on it. Yeah. Well, let's see. It's Tears Day today. August? No, September the 8th. Yeah, September the 8th, 2015, Tears Day. This is a big day around the bunker here. We get all prepared for it on Monday night, because on Tuesday morning, about 9 o'clock, the trash man comes, and that's the big event around here of the week. The dogs go crazy. They have their routine that they can hear that truck coming half a mile away. They hear it coming. And when they get here, boy, all hell breaks loose. Those dogs are out there trying to eat up the garbage man or the trash man. Incidentally, they're good white boys, too. They're not a bunch of Mexicanos or Negroes or African Americans. They're white boys. And we always say hello and give them a present at Christmas and all that kind of good stuff. Anyhow, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And that's where you send your donations for the radio show, and your September dues or donations are, we're looking forward to them. And we've gotten several in here already. So anyhow, that's about as much pushing for money you'll get out of me. Well, let's start off with a funny one on our black equality people. I think it's pretty funny. There's no end to the stupidity of some niggers and United States elected officials. Just when you think you've heard all of the stupid things that are going on in the U.S., this comes along. Now it's black hurricanes. Well, it appears our African Americans friends have found yet something else to be pissed about. A black congresswoman, this would be Sheila Jackson Lee of Houston, with an IQ of about 50, reportedly complained that the names of the hurricanes are all Caucasian-sounding names. She would prefer some names that reflect African-American culture, such as Jamiqua, Tanisha, Washiawasha, Shakwa, and Jamal. Hell, they sound like Indian names to me. I'm not making this up, boys and girls. She would also like the weather reports to be broadcast in a language that street people can understand, because one of the problems that happened in New Orleans was that black people couldn't understand the seriousness of the situation, even though the water was already around their neck, up to their neck. Understand the seriousness of the situation due to the racially biased language of the weather report. I guess if the weather person says that the winds are going to blow at 140 miles an hour, that's too hard to understand. I can hear it now. A weatherman in New Orleans says, "What's up, motherfuckers? Hurricane Jamiqua be heading for your ass like Leroy on a rocket. Bitch be category 4. So turn off them chitlins, grab your chin, leave your crib and head for the nearest FEMA office for your free shit." Yeah, that's the way you, that's what our African-American friends do. Hell, half of the African-American congressmen sound like that, or nearly like that, and they're supposed to be the best, the top of the breed. Wow. Well, the African-Americans have one peg they can hang their hat on, and that's this guy, Carson. This black guy is supposed to have been a brain surgeon or something. I'd like to know more about that. That reminds me of when I lived in Fallbrook, California years ago, and I knew this black couple. Once in a while we talked, and this black woman had to go into the Marine base, Camp Pendleton, and get some work done, some surgery. And she says, "I find me a white doctor. I don't want none of those nigger doctors." Anyhow, Ann Coulter, you know, that's the one with the big Adam's apple that everybody thinks she's a man. I think I debated her once or twice. Couldn't get a word in edgewise. She talks right over you. Ann Coulter retweeted Michael Allen G. I at least understand that one. "Carson is intelligent, brilliant, classy, well-spoken. But Trump wins on immigration," Ann Coulter added. So she thinks that African-American is all of those good things. So here's the answer to that. "Ann, where is your supporting evidence of Carson's brilliance? Until better advised, if Carson is truly brilliant, then he would be the first brilliant black man in history of the world. Where does Carson rank on the list of brilliant black men? Please include your list, starting with the most brilliant to the tenth brilliant black man. He looks to me like a house nigger, nonviolent. The essence of you granting him brilliance is because he's nonviolent, right? And that's what you Republicans love. Yeah, there's some more here. Oh. Yeah, about that nigger violence in Chicago over the weekend. I think it was around 10 got killed. Yeah. Yeah, that's about it for that. Okay. Well, at least this Negro told the truth. This was up in Detroit after a black witness observed the alleged thief rob two people at gunpoint. He apparently told the witnesses they didn't need to worry because he only robbed white people. Well, there's a truthful Negro. The alleged assailant, 24-year-old Brandon Lamar Williams, robbed two people at gunpoint, breaking one victim's nose in the process. And they didn't do a goddamn thing. Well, if he had a gun on him, I can probably understand that. While holding a gun in each hand, Williams allegedly walked up to the pair's Ford Fusion and demanded the car along with the Apple Watch and a bag. Williams also reportedly pointed the gun at one of the victims and squeezed the trigger, but the gun failed to fire. Ain't that just like a nigger? He's got two guns and the first didn't fire. He then pistol-whipped one of the victims and demanded that they both get out of the car. As the victims exited the vehicle, Williams continued hitting them, breaking the nose of one victim. Next, Williams attempted to escape but didn't realize the parking brake was on. An onlooker didn't realize what was going on and ran out to help Williams. He had then noticed the gun. In response to the passerby's stunned look, Williams replied, "You good, I only rob white people." Williams then left the Ford he was in and made his way to the stolen Jeep he'd been driving, but the Jeep got stuck and the police caught him. I love it. But not till after a chase went on. Williams fled the scene and led police on a 90-mile-an-hour chase and was thrown from the car after the crash. The alleged assailant is facing 25 years in jail, but they'll probably give him good behavior and he'll be out in two or three because he only robs white people. It's something else when white people say racist things and put it right out there and then deny they're racist. Here's a guy down in Texas. He's denying he's a racist. Can't play that one for you. YouTube has dropped it. I heard what he said before about a week ago, though. YouTube is real funny. All these services like that are controlled by people who are obviously our enemies, as they bump me off YouTube, too. But I'm back on there, and you'll have to figure out who I am. Now I'm going to play you a little excerpt from Black Radio. Believe it or not, I do listen to it frequently because it's unbelievable some of the crap you hear on black radio. And of course, they're racist as hell. I wouldn't say they're racist. I'd say they hate the white race. They may not hate each individual white person, but I think I feel the same way about the black race. Hating the race is one thing, and an individual once in a while, no, you don't. But anyhow, this woman has wormed her way into a position through the civil wrongs movement way back 20 years, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And she's got in through golf. And I want you to listen carefully on how these people worm their way in with the help of the rich whites and whites in power. So some of this may be a little boring, but listen to it. It'll show you how, as long as they're into diversity and race mixing, they're champions for the black race. Now, if she'd come on and say, I want race division, I want to secure my black race, they'd kick her ass off immediately. And also, it's always our people and we and our people. That's, you know, now name any white person and get away with that on radio. But if enough white people did it, they couldn't stop it. You can't blame it all on the Negroes because whites are so goddamn cowardly. I mean, they're cowardly to the extreme. Of course, they mask it with being Christian and all that kind of stuff and love your brother and we're all equal.
Public relations, marketing, and just how to empower yourself. So each time I would do one of my workshop seminars, they would say, Rose, you have to do a book. So that went on for about 3 years. So now you have the book in your hand.
And I'm
so pleased that that you know my dear friend as well, Ed Dwight, because I produced a mix of celebrity, corporate, political for 23 years. Ed Dwight was a major part of that. He would truck in from Denver, Colorado, many, many pieces of sculpture that showcase things at my set.
Wow.
And he'd make a purchase, he would give a contribution to my foundation. So he's a dear friend, and he's been doing good work in the area of empowerment of all people for years.
And please tell him that we talked. I can't wait to get the piece I just sent. I'm getting it. I told him, I guess one of my children and grandchildren will inherit it. But
oh, absolutely.
But part of the book, Art of the Deal, is to support also the Grass Ceiling Inc. The grass ceiling. It's a play on the word glass ceiling. Explain this this organization you founded as a business empowerment firm.
Well, Joe, I spent, as you know, over close to 30 years of my adult life on the professional a golf tour. And during that time, I was managing professional athletes and had an opportunity to negotiate contracts, endorsements, appearances around the globe. In fact, the game of golf has taken me to 6 continents. And as a woman of color and a woman, I learned an awful lot. I founded the Grass Ceiling because I feel that we should not have any barriers. Glass is a barrier, and I don't think we should always have to be cracking the glass. But grass allows us to go around and sometimes get to the top a little further and a little faster. Golf is the most powerful networking tool in the world. So the company was founded to empower, to provide a platform just to help to level the playing field for women and minorities with their counterparts in the business and the academic world. The game provides such a neutral zone to promote effective communications and positive bonding between professionals. So the Grass Ceiling has emerged out of my years of experience and exposure on how this game has worked for others, and I wanted to share my experiences and help to educate others through the importance of using golf as a business tool, not just to have fun with, but to understand how it can open many, many doors. And particularly one of the things that people miss a lot is the importance of why our young people should embrace this game, particularly young African-American children who will be able to earn full golf scholarships to go to colleges of their choice.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the Ivy League schools. They're
right.
Looking for young people with this knowledge and with this skill base. So it's a very, very important tool, and I'm not talking about just to advocate to become professional golfers. but how do you use the game of golf to acquire your professional education? Joe, you know, when you have young people and they're going for interviews, or seniors, it doesn't have to just be young people, there's a very subtle question that is often asked of people, and they say, hey, do you play golf? It's not written on any of their documents, but it is a very important question.
I have I've had more people.
You're listening to the Black Eagle. We're not taking phone calls
I'm
now.
I'm dealing with folks I have to interview. And let's talk about the fact that it's people of all walks of life. But I went out to interview Jim Brown. Now, I would talk football with Jim Brown, right?
Right.
But guess
right.
what the first question he asked me
right.
while we were social? Hey, Joe, do you play golf?
Right.
Then I had, who was it? We had Sugar Ray Leonard. Sat right
yeah.
after the interview. We had a really
right.
nice hour-long interview. Hey, man, if you
right.
come out to California, do you play golf?
Right.
I mean, you're absolutely, that inevitably that comes up no matter if it's a corporate executive. The four tops, I got to be honest to tell you, when all of them were living and they would be on a tour bus. And
right.
they said in order to be part of their group, I swear, that's what Levi Sub said, you got to play golf.
Yep, exactly. It's very, you know, golf gives you access, Joe, to look, if I use myself as
now we're getting there.
In my presentations often. I have been in the Oval Office, I think, more times than most.
Come on. Why? Because you play golf?
Exactly. That is the reason. When the new presidents come into office here, I've just written them a little letter over the years welcoming to my town. I'm born here. This is my city. And
now you're talking about Washington, D.C.
I can play a little golf. If you're ever interested in having any matches, let me know. Well, the first one that responded to me was President Gerald Ford. As a result of that, I worked with him for close to 15 years on his golf tournament in Vail, Colorado. He called me from Air Force One one day and said, Rose, I got a little tournament I'm working on up here in Vail. Would like to know if you would help me with it. We became very good friends. He was a wonderful person. I got to know the family. And so every year I was in Vail, Colorado. I wouldn't have been there had it not been for golf. And then President Bush, the father, I set up several golf matches for him. And Gerald Ford was the first president to make a public appearance in my golf event that I produced some 20-some years ago. And it's because of Gerald Ford that the pro-ams on the PGA circuit today has the level of support and celebrityness because Gerald Ford was one of those that played, first one to open the door
yeah.
and play in those tournaments. So golf for me has been and continues to be a blessing, and I just wanted to share that with
you. Yeah, and the book, it's a paperback book. We'll put it on our Facebook and also on our website under I would also appreciate it. We've already got it posted on the Facebook. All right, about that you mentioned quite already that it's a tool for diversity and inclusion. Because that's
yeah.
what I really hear you
yeah.
say.
Yeah.
So let me ask you about the role of women and particularly minority women
yeah.
using this as a tool for diversity and inclusion, because I went online and I pulled up the various tournaments, the Swinging
right.
Skirt Tournament, the Volunteer of American. One of the things
right.
I've noticed is a lack of African American, but I also noticed quite a few Asian professional players. So I'm kind of curious as to why they appear to dominate the sport professionally.
Well, first of all, I'm glad that you've done that research, because there is such an absence of African American women in this sport, and it should not be. But it has, it exists for several reasons, Joe, because there has not, prior to the past 15 years or so, has not been easy for them to have access into this industry because of the many barriers that are there. It is opening up, and I think the more that the women are becoming educated on how to use golf as a serious global business tool, then they're going to connect with it and understand how it helps them in all walks of life, from professional to social. Now, diversity and inclusion, this is the number one tool for that. I mean, many corporations talk diversity and inclusion, but they really don't implement it in a way that is meaningful. If you look at, I think in the book I have a team of women there, Asian, African-American, white women, all four different ethnicities. Now, when we're on the golf course, nobody is going to say, oh, you know, what ethnicity, you know, what is your background? No, we're all there to play golf. We're all there for the same reason, and that is for the game. However, after the game,
yeah,
we have had an opportunity for 2.5 hours or 4 hours to get to know each other as individuals, as
people,
as another human being,
mm-hmm,
as someone who enjoys the same kind of sport. Now, while you're doing that, while you're on the golf course, I teach you how to decipher whether or not this person is of good character. Is this really someone you want to do business with or not? You forget all about what color they are,
yeah,
what gender they are. And they're all interested in the same thing, from the tee to the green.
Making money.
Accomplishing that par or that birdie, or getting no more than a bogey. But at the end of the day, Joe, when
yeah,
they all come,
we're about 30 seconds, uh-huh,
you're going to see that the diversity here has totally been absorbed with the use of the game, and it's powerful. It's very, very powerful.
Right.
So I'm encouraging more people to really take a look at it. And when you see a woman like Sheila Johnson,
right?
Well, it took a while to get there, but you get the point. You get the point. You know, basketball, baseball, football, golf, gradually worming their way in. And they're worming their way in with a lot of help from whites, rich corporate whites, who they say, oh, it's a little hard to deal with the corporations, but eventually they get in. So that's the way it goes. Now, these rich people, they'd rather deal with a nigger on the golf course than deal with a white working man, I'll tell you that. Yeah. Well, let's get back to our book on Negro inferiority. I don't think anybody in the country is reading these books like this on the radio. It cannot be said that the almost universal backwardness in all individual and social advances based on intelligence is attributed to unfavorable circumstances. The conditions of civilization have been favorable. I doubt if it can be shown that any other continental area has been blessed with climate, soil, topography, and other adjuvants equally favorable for human progress. They're talking about Africa. The climate ranges from warm temperate in the north to warm temperate of the south. It has an equal distribution of the sun's annual heat over parts lying north and south of central line. No portion of the continent is given over to eternal frost nor insufferable seasons. The genial sky spares its populations the forethought, labor, time, or of provision against severe and protracted winters. Over most of the continent, rains are adequate in supply and in distribution throughout the year. Well, not so much so now. The vast interior, including nearly all south of the Sahara, is an undulating plateau averaging 4,000 to 5,000 feet above the sea level, with numerous mountain ranges attaining 10 to 16,000 feet. The tropical climate is therefore fairly untempered to human endurance, certainly to Negro endurance. Only the Sahara and the Nubian portions suffer from intense heat. The climates are also salubrious, save portions of the lower low borders, especially on the west coast. Salt is plentifully distributed, with local exceptions. Copper exists in large quantities in the center of South Africa, and iron is more widely known. Diamonds are abundant in the district of Vale and Orange Rivers north of Cape Colony. Abundance of forest growths cover much of the interior. The farther from the equatorial line, fine parks and pasture lands invite the presence of agriculture and herding. Great rivers drain the continent, which after the passage of the falls, which occur on the borders of the Great Plateau, furnish navigable channels of communications between all parts of productive interior. The navigable river and the lake system is unsurpassed in extent that of any country in the world. The mixed races have utilized these advantages to considerable extent. The delta of the Niger is much more extensive than the Nile. The Congo, the Mississippi of Africa, is from 1 to 3 miles in diameter and discharges 2 million cubic feet of water per second. The Great Lakes Victoria and Albert cover each about 30,000 square miles. Many other lakes of fresh water exist, which add to the resources of the interior, in the same manner as the Great Lakes of North America. The considerable elevation of these lakes and the discharge of vast amounts volumes of water must supply the regions between them and the sea level a surprising amount of water power. The native productions of Africa suited to wants of man are quite numerous. The date palm thrives throughout all the desert regions wherever a moderate supply of water can be had. It furnishes the bread of the desert and supports not only man but camel and horse. Wine is produced from the sap south of the Sudan. The baobab, or monkey bread tree, takes the place of the date. Here abounds also the oil plant, palm. Other vegetable resources of the continent are the doom palm and the butter tree. There are two native cereals, Negro millet and coffer corn, which supply ferruginous food. There are also the edible bread roots and earth nuts, which are adequate to supply the daily food of whole villages. Moreover, for thousands of years, the way has been open as wide as the continent for the introduction of the cereals of Asia. These indeed are not entirely unknown to the natives, and maize, the mano root, and sugarcane have been introduced from America by the Europeans and have begun to spread towards the interior. The domesticatable and useful animals of Africa are not inconsiderable in number. Perhaps the 94 species of the quadrumana peculiar to Africa are more noisy and curious than useful. The continent is well stocked with fur-bearing animals whose skins, if not needed by the natives, would be valuable for export. The quagga and the mountain zebra represent the horse family in the southern parts, while Burchell's zebra is widely scattered over the plains as far as Abyssinia and the west coast, and their aboriginal wild ass is indigenous to the northeastern Africa. The domestic horse has not been introduced into tropical Africa. The single-humped camel, or dromedary, is employed over all North Africa, and the Indian buffalo has also been introduced in the north. Other native bovine and ovine species are extensively distributed, while Africa is the peculiar country of the antelope and the giraffe. Lastly, the African elephant ranges abundantly from Cape Colony throughout Central Africa. Of course, you know, this was written quite a long time ago. But strange to say, it has never been, like the Indian elephant, domesticated. The only gallinaceous bird is the guinea fowl, but this exists in great abundance, and partridges and quails are distributed over most parts of the continent. It is pertinent to inquire if such a continent, so outfitted with resources for food, clothing, and transportation, intercommunication, and commerce, is a situation suited to cramp the manhood of an indigenous race. Are these the conditions under which the grade of humanity would sink from the level of Adam and Noah to that of a naked black skin driveling in filth and wretchedness on the banks of the Congo or the Zambezi? While under the climatic vicissitudes of Western Asia and Europe, the same type has risen perpetually throughout all grades of advancing civilizations. The indigenous African has nowhere taken more than the first step towards civilization. Some of the tribes have indeed learned the art of producing iron, but it is a greater wonder that they have not discovered in it the resources of civilization. It has been said that the African elephant is incapable of domestication, but its affinity to the Asiatic species renders that statement incredible. Indeed, the conviction already exists in South Africa that it is equally well adapted for labor, and there can be no doubt would be as easily tamed as his Indian elephant. That this is the case is ample proof by the docile and submissive state into which both male and female elephants have been brought in zoological gardens and menageries. Nor have any of the equine species been domesticated. Some domesticated animals introduced from Asia are known to the most advanced Africans, but no native species has ever been domesticated. In America, under conditions certainly no more favorable, a semi-civilization has grown up indigenously. The only serial native to America is maize, and until the occupation by Europeans, no Asiatic cereal was accessible. The principal edible roots of America are the mandioca and the potato, while the feeble hama and the vicua are the only native animals available for domestication as a beast of burden. These have been utilized from time immemorial. In contrast with Africa, the civilizations of Nahuatl, nations of Mexico, and Quinches of Central America, the Mayas of Yucatan, and the Quanchas of Peru had become, both in respect to intellectual and industrial advances and judicial, moral, and religious conceptions, almost a stage of true enlightenment. Our wonder at the stationary savagedom of virgin Africa is greatly enhanced when we reflect on the relations of civilized peoples to that continent. Ever since the dawn of Akkadian civilization in Western Asia, an open highway of communications has existed between the continents, not to speak of actual communications across the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb. More than this, Asiatic civilizations entered Africa and spread itself over the valley of the Nile and the Mediterranean border at a period so remote as to be obscured by the twilight of human history. It brought with it the cereals and finally the domesticated animals of Asia. It introduced the arts and industry and rudiments of science. It established a religious cult which was monotheistic and remarkably pure and elevated. It opened commercial intercourse not only with Arabia, Palestine, and Babylonia, but with the tribes of the Upper Nile and the Libyan region. It engaged in extensive mining operations, not only in the Sinai Peninsula, but in the far southern countries of the Nashi, Negroes. It worked quarries of limestone and granite on an enormous scale. It tilled the soil in the presence of the most forbidding obstacles to be found in habitable Africa. It sent warlike expeditions not only to Asia Minor, but to Assyria-Babylonia, but into Nubian Ethiopia, and even the armies of the civilized people inevitably sow the germs of civilization among barbarians. The Negroes have been in contact with these people for 4,000 years, and save through infusion of blood, they have not yet learned the first lesson in civilization. Are these people whom adverse circumstances have crushed from the grade of atomic civilization and forbidden to rise, even while the hands of Egypt and Libya and Assyria and Arabia were outstretched to lift them up? The thought is inadmissible. Constitutional, aboriginal, deep-seated incapacity is the only explanation of these amazing phenomena. We may further contrast the immobility of the Negroes in conflict with civilization with the facile and eager improvement of once savage Anthropococcus Maoris of New Zealand. The Maoris belong to a type sometimes distinguished as Polynesian. It is perhaps a hybrid of Malay and Papuan. They reached their islands about 1400 A.D., and the English took possession in 1769. In 1853, they had made such advancement that the governor, Sir George Grey, reported that both races already form one harmonious community, connected by commercial agricultural pursuits, possessing the same faith, resorting to the same courts of justice, joining the same public sports, standing mutually and indifferently to each other in the relation of landlord and tenant, and thus insensibly forming one people. That seems to be a little bit bizarre, so-called race mixing between the non-white Maoris and the white New Zealanders. There's still a lot of problems going on down there. Mr. Edward Norris says they now, in 1855, vie with Englishmen in many of their pursuits. They are expert riders, breeders of horses. They understand perfectly how to make a bargain. They erect buildings, cultivate land, form good roads far beyond the limits of the English settlements. The more opulent among them become the shipowners, landlords, and millers, the latter being especially a favorite occupation. The poorer people make roads, till the ground, tend cattle, build houses and ships, fish for whales, and navigate ships generally. According to the good authority, the most regular, clean, and orderly of all the coasting vessels plying between Auckland and the Bay of Islands is owned and manned wholly by natives and is preferable by the public as a conveyance for passengers before all others. They resort readily to the English law courts. You see, these people are Asian or some type of Asian hybrid. So they don't—they're not classed, of course, as a Negro. Okay. Yet even Maoris are described as quite inferior intellectually to Englishmen. I need only to refer to the familiar history of the Sandwich Islands to further enforce the significance of the comparison. In fact, all Polynesia is fairly represented by these examples. It would be proper to raise the question whether the Negro is capable of appreciating, desiring, and conserving the benefits of civilization. The inertia of the Negro in a state of servitude, his scarcely improved condition, and certain diminution in numbers since enfranchisement in the United States, his political and social career in Haiti, his massacre of the agents, and destruction of the agencies of civilization in St. Thomas, this helplessly subordinate station in the northern states of our Union and in Canada, his indifference to the benefits of civilization in Liberia, the persistent vitality of voodooism among American Negroes in the close environment of the high civilization, and the Negroes' facile relapses, and as in the Congo nation, into a state of abject barbarism. As soon as the props of foreign aid are removed, constitute a set of facts for grave reflection. If the Negro is constitutionally incapable of availing himself of Caucasian civilization, how many lives shall we sacrifice, and how many millions shall we lavish in attempts to foist it upon him? I hope I shall not be set down as unfriendly to the Negro. Should any person deem me so, I extend to them all the pity deserved by ignorance and error. And this guy is trying to cover his ass. Even back then, I shall not feel hurt. I have no special occasion for unfriendliness towards the Negro. And Tommy would say, other than the fact that they're inferior race of people that get in our way. The world would be better if he were an efficient factor in an enlightened humanity, whatever that means. The country would be better if he were an elevating and progressive influence instead of a depressing and barbarizing one. I should like to see, I suppose that means he's a friend of these people. If that's friendship, I don't know what enemies. I should like to see him capable of coping with his white rival, or at least profiting by his example and aid. I will do all possible to make him do so. In other words, maybe he in the long run believes in race mixing. But the work must be prosecuted with a clear view of the facts. We defeat the end by proceeding blindfold. I'm not responsible for the inferiority which I discover existing. I'm only contemplating a range of facts which seems to prove such inferiority. I am responsible if I ignore the facts and their teaching and act towards the Negroes as if he were capable of all the responsibilities of the white race. I am responsible if I grant him privileges which he can only pervert to his detriment and mine, or impose upon him duties which he is incompetent to perform or even to understand. The similar inferiority of other black races it would not be difficult to prove. The measurements already given show that the Australian to possess an organism quite inferior to that of the Negro. In intelligence, he is said to be so low as to be unable to count over 4 or 5 of the actus of the Philippines. De La Gornier says that they gave him the impression of being a great family of monkeys. Their voices recalled the short cry of these animals, and their movements strengthened the analogy. Buchner says that the toes of these savages, who live partly in grottos, partly on trees, are very mobile and more separated than ours, especially the great toe. They use them in maintaining themselves on branches and cords as with fingers. According to Buchner, the language of the savages of Borneo is rather a kind of warbling or croaking than a truly human mode of expression. The Vedas of Ceylon, says Sir Emerson Tennant, communicate among themselves almost entirely by means of signs, grimaces, guttural sounds resembling very little true words or true language. The Dokos of Abyssinia, according to Kraft, are human pygmies. They are not more than 4 feet high, and their skin is of an olive brown. Wanderers in the woods, they live like animals, without habitation, without sacred trees. They go naked, nourishing themselves by roots, fruit, mice, serpents, ants, honey. They climb trees like monkeys. Without chief, without law, without arms, without marriage, they have no family, and mate by chance. Like animals, they also multiply rapidly. The mother, after a short lactation, abandons her child to itself. They neither hunt, nor cultivate, nor sow, and they never have known the use of fire. They have thick lips, a flattened nose, little eyes, long hair, hands and feet with great nails, of which they dig in the soil. Some of the American tribes remain at the lowest point of degradation. This is the case with the Fuengia, and the Batugas of Brazil have been often cited. Of the latter, Lalaman says, "I am sadly convinced that they are monkeys with two hands." In the presence of a body of facts like those cited in the present chapter, it seems impossible to doubt that nature has established a wide range of gradations among the races, which cannot be obliterated by any influence having less than secular duration. It seems beyond all rational question that the Aborigines of Africa are vastly inferior to the Mediterranean race, and that consequently, if they and the other black races are the posterior of the biblical Adam, the world has witnessed a great scene of degradation and retrogression, which almost reflects on an infinite wisdom and beneficence. Forget that Adam stuff. It could be symbolic of something else, but the whole story's spooks in the sky. And that is the end of the reading of that particular pamphlet that came to me via The Thunderbolt. It's written by Alexander Winchell. So The Thunderbolt way back dug it up and reprinted it. No, I'm wrong. That wasn't The Thunderbolt. That was Sons of Liberty. That was James K. Warner's outfit operating out of Hollywood, North Hollywood at one time. I don't know what I told you. I got a new sign up in front of my house. The paranoid, only the paranoid will survive. I wonder how many people that go by really understand what that means. Well, let's close out the show with a little more exciting reading from The Might is Right. Heredity has ever so much more to do with the social conditions than the majority of modern men are willing to admit. Judging by the results that nations that ignore birth and breeding at their peril, for just as there are noble animals, there are noble men. If a stock grazer throws down his dividing fences and permits all his cattle to mix up promiscuously together, what kind of a herd would he have, say, in one decade? Nothing but weeds and hybrids of mongrels. That's what's happening in this country right now, and it's happening very fast. Now that it is exactly what nations attempt when they endeavor to establish an equality of privileges and of happy, peaceful conditions. The close psychological connection that exists between ancestry and degeneracy, crime, genius, insanity, and so on, is now everywhere being acknowledged, thanks to the researchers of Galton, Lombroso, Moza, Otto Ammann, Ferry, Kraft, Ebbing, and others. Yeah, but we learned it, and then all of a sudden the government taught us how to forget it, or at least most of us. If criminals are criminals by descent or by birth, it is not equally probable that slaves are slaves by the facts of their breed and ancestry. Does it not also follow that heroes and strong, powerful, resolute personalities have derived their solid stamina from their forefathers? Indeed, all history and all genealogies prove that this is a mathematical fact. Great men are ever descendants of mighty warriors and conquerors, that is to say, of mighty animals. Von Otto Ammann cites a remarkable instance which goes to prove the selective and ethnic advantages of warfare. He states that all German children born before the Franco-Prussian campaign of 71, also the years immediately following, show a strikingly high average of excellence both of body and mind. The converse is equally demonstrable. Show me a herd of humans who have been undurfed day drudges from their youth up, and I will show you a herd of cattle whose ancestors were also propertyless, vassals and serfs, beaten in diplomacy and in war for ages past. Take the Irish peasantry and the Fellahin of Egypt as examples. This statement admits of no qualification, for in one exception can be discovered, it will serve to prove the general rule. A man in full possession of his faculties of Loinin ancestry, well-born, self-contained, would rather cut his own throat from ear to ear with a blacksmith's rasp than to live the life of an average hired laborer in any civilized hell on earth. The nexus between self-mastership and breed is of tremendous significance. Therefore is the lost secret. Undoubtedly, newborn infants are daily coming wailing into the world with the words statement, statesman, tramp, wastrel, warrior, priest, philosopher, criminal, thief, king, slave, and coward indelibly branded upon their brows, their hearts, and their brains. Our talents, our virtues, and our vices depend entirely upon our individual mechanism, and that mechanism is the result of countless chemic transformations extending over the ages, but modified to the large extent by climate and soil. What is bred in the bone will never come out of the flesh, wrote Pilpay thousands of years ago. There is a pregnant ethnic philosophy in four lines. This clay, well mixed with marl and sand, follows the motions of my hand. For some must follow and some must command, though all are made of clay. Although all may be made of clay in the poetic sense, it must never be forgotten that the clay itself is composed of the differential elements. The clay that is in the blackfellow or the Chinaman is not the clay that is in a Shakespeare or a Bismarck. Some clay will grow good wheat and make very bad bricks, just as some breeds of animals are born to be hunters and others born to be hunted. Some clay will raise splendid crops, even from poor seed, and some never produce anything, no matter how highly cultivated, except thorns and weeds and nettles and prisons and poisons. The natures of men are molded almost entirely by the nature of the soil from which they have been grown. Man is a perambulating crop. In some places, he grows to perfection. In other localities, he won't grow at all, or runs to seed. In India, the Anglo-Saxon dwines and dwindles, but in Canada and the northern states, he even develops increased stamina. All science, all history, all experience are unanimous in disproof of equal natural rights of all men. That strident doctrine of the fool, and yet the insolent, proofless assertions of a Zeno, a Jefferson, a Jack Cade, a Robespierre, or a Jewish carpenter, when fantastically engrossed and framed or bound in a book, are passively accepted by intellectual serfs of this degenerate 19th century and trumpeted to the ends of the earth as a sublime and holy revelation. Equalitism passes almost unchallenged in public orations because to open questions to its veracity is felt to be unpopular. Correct speech. And with the ignoble leaders of public opinion in all democracies, popularity is everything. The alpha and the omega, the beginning and the end. The result in Anglo-Saxondom is simply nauseous. Young men are mentally mutilated systematically, educated by schools, press, and literature upon fundamental hallucinations, pyrotechnic shams, and glittering illusions, the illusions that are the perennial sources of fruitless servile uprisings. Social heart burnings, interscene unpleasantness, and a sundry of other secondary symptoms of social cancer. Our government educational systems are absolutely under the direct control of politicians. These priests of the state select and train the teachers, vote the salaries, and dictate what truths and lies the textbooks shall contain. Indeed, our national schools are managed upon the same Jesuitic plan. whereby the monks and the prelates of old successfully worked the universal church. Come right in here and we'll improve your mind free of cost, suavely said the high priest of this new idolatry, this devouring dragon, this impersonal state. So the pure-hearted, rosy-cheeked, and little ones enter unsuspectingly, dumped on the doorstep by their parents and driven to school. Gradually, they are brought under the influence. The gray-brained pulp is forced out of a plastic young skull and lies nice, pretty, poet lies mixed with unavoidable facts and perverted truths, skillfully injected. Did you ever see medical students extract the brain of a frog and fill up the vacuum with pith? The frog does not die. It lives, hops about quite lively, and seems to possess a former intelligence and vitality, but it is an illusion. What experimental vivisectionists do to frogs, state priests do to the children of men. Bit by bit, with dates and lists, and emasculated histories, the iniquitous, brain-wrecking deviltry proceeds. When completed, young men and women are turned out with addled brains into a warring world, incapables, semi-imbeciles, unable to defend or assert themselves, footballs of fate, ready to serve anyone. It is not notorious. The ineptitude, the mechanical initiation, and want of initiative displayed by the state-educated young men. Instead of being urged to think and act for themselves, they're taught like well-drilled slaves to believe and obey. They're even trained to glorify and worship idols with strident shouts and modulated canticles. Not honest idols of wood and stone, but idols of sheepskin, bound pamphlets, variegated rags, and the falsified renown of dead scoundrels and i.e. statesmen. It requires a stout rope, a firm post, and muscular men to hold an unbroken colt. But when by force and petting he has once been subdued, tamed, educated, saddled, bridled, he may be led anywhere, even with a piece of twine in the hands of a little child. O ye state priests, so adroit, so eloquent, ye cunning devils, ye wolves in sheep's clothing, ye corruptors of the youth, ye generation of vipers, how can you escape the wrath to come? How can you escape someday from being hung up by the tongue on the red-hot hooks of the real live hell? 30 years ago, the United States quixotically essayed to demonstrate racial equality with rifle butts and bombshells, but failed most ignominiously. Southern valleys were strewn with the northern and southern bones and millions of tax treasures blown from the lips of cannons without any tangible result, except to demonstrate before an interesting world the utter failure and hollowness of equality principles. A people that deliberately enters upon a giant war in order to firmly establish a centralized despotism and at the same time reduce itself to the social level of the Negro, the Russian Jew, the coolie, the Chinaman, and the European serf must indeed, to use a suggestive vernacularism, have wheels in his head. The man and brother lie has certainly succeeded in writing itself in a constitutional amendment, but a real life it is as far as from actuality as ever was. The free Negro of New Orleans or Charleston is the more degraded, more despised being and of less money value to his proprietors now than when it was customary to buy and sell him on the auction block instead of as a present on the stock exchange. What the late Civil War really accomplished was to degrade the white slave to the lower level of the plantation nigger. And in that respect, it was a triumph of ingenuity. The whites actually fought each other to demonize themselves. Equality, equality. What brilliant deeds have been perpetuated in thy name. Lincoln, however, was he not a great statesman? Decidedly he was. Well, indeed, he knew how to round up the herd with bewitching phrases. Hark, do you hear those drunken slaves caterwauling down the street? Lo, it's election night. Hooray, hooray, they sing. We'll sound the jubilee. Glory be to Lincoln, the man who made us free. In Morocco, the eunuchs and other menials bless their fate and the prince at the every time he condescends to cut their throats with his own hands. Americans, however, are a free-born people, not to be duped that way. Throughout both northern and southern states, the social chasm between the highest and lowest human organisms, whether white or black and tan, is even more pronounced now than ever it was previously. For example, although the Negroes are a majority in many states, they are never permitted to attain actual administrative power, and they never shall. Well, that's questionable. You cannot paint the Negro white with laws and constitutions, though you write it in the fire and smoke of wars and revolutions. Well, anyhow, that's it for today. I'll be back with you tomorrow on Wotan's Day. We may stick with the Might is Right here for a while. Got me excited. 14:05. I have nothing to say, you asshole, and I'm not going to say anything because you'll say I'm lying and you'll give me 5 years for saying it. I know, and I'm not no stupid. Yeah.
Your generals are bandits. Wars on the Catholic King of France. You employ any mercenary you can get. Wars on the Catholic King of Spain. And abort the place politics, as by 100 other princes, kings, bishops.
All for their own rotten purposes.
All sides are rotten, except for people like you. Religious fanatics who incite murder for the sake of a god they have never known. Don't you understand? There is no god!
Michael.
We live, we fight, and we die for each other, not for you.